Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Hardware Unboxed podcast for episode 12. In this episode, we go on a bit of a rant about how the Epic Game Store kind of sucks, and that's 100% why it keeps losing tons of money. We're also going to be looking into AMD's driver support for older GPUs. We've got some questions about YouTube Adblock. And then, yeah, our boring lives, a bit of a chat about TV shows that we've been watching and other things. So plenty to get to in this episode. Let's get into it. Steve, we're back. Another podcast. How are you going?
Good, thank you. The big 12-0. No, just 12.
Just 12, oh, yeah, just 12.
I wish it was, well, yeah. It was 11 though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got it right. I was pretty happy with myself. I didn't have to delete the whole podcast episode, so that was nice.
Okay, so we're, yep, okay, 12th one in. That's good. No, going pretty good. Been doing a few interesting things. Nothing terribly exciting, I have to admit, but we'll probably talk about that towards the end.
We got a few, let's start with the first topic because this is one where, going a bit of a rant because this is a topic about the Epic Game Store losing heaps of money.
Oh, no.
So basically, as part of there's currently some Epic lawsuits going on at the moment. I believe it's between Epic and Apple and Epic and Google, all sorts of different battles going on at the moment. The head of the Epic Game Store, Steve Allison's come out and basically said, the Epic Game Store, it's not profitable. It's actually lost money since it came out in 2018. They're not expecting it to be profitable by 2025, and they're expecting their combined losses to be around $965 million by 2027. And I guess there was sort of, you know, this is a big PC topic because a lot of people are having to use the Epic Game Store for some games today, like Alan Wake 2, for example, Fortnite games that are not available on Steam. And they had this idea that they were going to buy all these exclusives and that would lead to 50% of all PC gaming sales. But just judging by what they're saying, it kind of hasn't worked at all for them.
The Epic Game Store, while not the worst game client, I suppose you'd call it, it's still nowhere near as good as Steam, in my opinion. I don't know what your opinion is there of it. Steam's just, first of all, not to sound like a Steam fanboy or anything, because we absolutely want competition to Steam. You don't want one game platform to rule them all, because then you end up with like a Microsoft Windows type situation where they can kind of just do whatever they want. They can screw over game developers. They can screw over gamers. And really, there's no alternative. Like, you kind of just have to cop it. So we absolutely want a genuine contender to Steam. The problem is the Epic Game Store just, it's not that and hasn't been yet. Sort of, I suppose we hoped that it got as good. And what I look for in these things probably differs a bit to other gamers because, you know, I'm mostly testing games. I have a huge games library. But Steam's just so much better than all the competition for keeping your games updated. It's quick and easy to navigate. It's easy to find your games. It does a good job of separating the bloat, let's say, from what gamers actually want, which is to find their games, load them, update them, do all that kind of stuff. So I feel like Steam is by far and away the gold standard for that, and by a long shot. It's significantly better. So it doesn't shock me to hear that it's not profitable. I guess, first of all, we'd have to explore, like, how does a game store make money, right? And yeah, really, it's obviously from selling games and having gamers on their, like, what, platform, I suppose you would call it. They're like,
yeah,
they're, because Steam almost in a way feels like, and in some ways it is, its own like operating system, because, you know, you can use it on certain devices as an operating system.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that. So I guess that's why it feels like that. But within Windows, it's just so well organized and laid out, in my opinion. And I don't think, have they changed it too much over the years? It seems like it's
Steam.
You could almost call Steam a bit dated in the way it looks, but it just works.
Yeah, they've been they had a major update in terms of its like interface. I think it was a couple of years ago, and they've slowly
I remember something like that.
Was it things?
Was it radically different? I don't remember. I remember there was definitely some polish added to it.
I think it's a coat of paint type thing. Like the general layout of things was the same, which obviously assists with navigation because you can remember where all the things are.
Yeah, I don't know if it's one of those situations where it has changed quite dramatically, but because it's happened slowly over such a long period of time, it's likely going to notice. But regardless, it's very good to use. I use all of them daily a lot because it's kind of my job. I guess one way to put it is, and I think this does relate back to gamers. If a game like Alan Wake 2 comes out or whatever as an exclusive on the Epic Game Store, I'm constantly like, well, I want it on Steam, because for me personally, Steam, again, you launch Steam, oh, Alan Wake 2 needs an update, cool, it updates it. Whereas the Epic Game Store generally does that, but not always. And then what's Ubisoft's? Is it called Uplay now?
Ubisoft Connect.
UConnect?
Yeah.
That one's historically been awful for that. So I'll load the software up, I'll have it open for 10 minutes. I'll be like, okay, I've got to go test Rainbow Six Siege, for example. I click on it, updating, 10 gigabyte update. I'm like, why didn't you do this for the last 10 minutes while my internet connection's been doing nothing, or at least notify me that there's a game update? But it doesn't do it until, I don't know if they've changed that. I haven't noticed.
No, they haven't
changed that. So I think that information is up to date. Whereas again, you launch Steam, it gives you a list of the games that are scheduled to be updated. It updates them. You can update them straight away. You don't really get caught out there. So in the morning, I'll open up Steam. I'll be like, okay, there's 20 game updates because I have like 100 and something games installed. Do them all, and then I can get on with it. You open up, you know, UConnect, and every time I click on a game, it's like, oh, now I've got to wait for this one to update. It's just crap. Yeah. So basically, I wait. If I know there's a game that's going to be a temporary exclusive to one of the competing platforms, I will just wait and buy it on Steam. And I think a lot of people do that. Like, they just, because whenever you Google, when's it coming to Steam? There's just countless people asking the same question. So that's not good for your game platform. So I think first and foremost, Epic Games needs to work out, why is Steam so popular? Why do games flock to Steam? And then work that out and then emulate that. Like, you know, basically essentially copy what they're doing right and try to improve it or whatever. But like, their layout is so, like, what's the EA one even? What's the EA one called these days? Because they're all the same. There's like EA Play, UConnect, Epic Games. Like, they're all kind of a clone. It's like they've copied, instead of going, what's the gold standard? What's the best? Which is Steam. They've gone, we need to copy EA. And then EA is like copying, and they've all copied the crap version, because am I right in saying they're all remarkably similar in the way the games libraries laid out, the features they have.
They use like a box art layout as sort of the default, where each of the game has like a small text and then the box art, whereas Steam is more of a list.
Yeah.
So,
well, and Steam, you can change I think the key to Steam is like the earlier versions of Windows, that it is quite customizable to, and there's different modes in which you can view it and things like that. Whereas you don't really get that with the competing software. They're just janky. They're just not as good.
Yeah.
The updating games thing for me is a big one.
When I go, like, I'm very similar to you. Like, I've even rebought games that I already own on the Epic Game Store on Steam, because it's that much better for testing and things like that. Like, I think I rebought Hitman and a few other titles once they came
Control,
across.
All those sort of games. But even things that you would use as a gamer, like just backing up, copying your games to a new location, having multiple different game locations. Like, that's such a breeze with Steam. Like, you want to move a game from A to B, done. You want
it's
to
all
back
built-in
up a game.
Functionality, right?
It just detects the game instantly and you're done. There's any updates that need to be applied, it detects the game. Yep, that's the Steam version of the game. There's an update for that. Let's update it, move on, done. Try doing that with, like, the EA version or the other versions.
It's horrendous. Some of those are so bad at doing it.
I think Epic Games is really, really bad at that, the backing up games.
It's horrible,
copying.
Yeah. Ubisoft Connect's actually quite good at that. You can just, they've got, like, a select the directory.
It says locate, locate game location or something like that. That does work quite well.
If your launcher doesn't have that, what are you doing? Like, people these days, especially with, like, the cost of SSDs and things, it's quite likely they'll have, like, maybe a 1 or 2 terabyte main SSD, and then they've upgraded and they've bought a second 2 terabyte SSD or a 4 terabyte or something for more games. And on Steam, it's like all of those games, you can just one click change them from one SSD to the other SSD. Mm-hmm. It automatically detects where all your library locations are. So it'll even have like multiple tabs for like your C drive, D drive, E drive game libraries. And it just makes that so easy. Whereas with Epic, it's like, I'm downloading a new game. It's defaulted to the C drive, but I actually want to put it on the D drive. Oh, I accidentally downloaded it to the wrong SSD, so it's run out of space. Now I have to move it across. So then I have to like start the download, pause it, close Epic Games, copy it over, reopen it, hope that it redetects that the game's downloaded. It's garbage.
And the gamers don't want that.
I feel like that's something that I value highly as a reviewer because I'm moving games a lot, I'm changing libraries and SSDs and PCs a lot. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, I feel like that's a legit use case for just a casual everyday gamer. Like, my actual gaming PC has 2 SSDs in it, each with its own set of game libraries on it because, you know, I needed more space. So I just added another SSD in. And yeah, Epic is just horrible for that. But the biggest issue, even more than that, is just how slow it is to do anything. Like, opening... It takes ages. I can't remember how many times I've clicked remember me for my username and password credentials, and it has never once remembered my information. Like Steam, you log in once and it pretty much always
that's
just remembers that that's your PC. It's always logged in. It doesn't matter if you restart or open it. Epic Games, about 10% of the time it remembers me. The other 90% of the time I need to enter my username and password again. Why have a remember me button if it doesn't effing work?
To be fair, I don't have that problem too much with Epic Games, but I acknowledge that it can be a problem. To be fair, Epic Games is worlds better than Uconnect and the EA Play or whatever it is in that regard. Yeah. Like, at least with the Epic Games Store, you can have it on your desktop PC, your work PC, your home theater PC, your phone, your tablet. You can have it installed in all of those locations, and then using the same username, you can be logged into all of them at the same time, which is exactly what you can do with Steam. Except with Uconnect, you can only be logged onto one device. If I have two systems, right, say I'm testing CPUs on one and GPUs on the other, and one of the systems dares to open Uconnect, but it's open on the other one. It logs you out. It's unbelievable. But not only do you have to it's not even as convenient. The inconvenience isn't even as convenient as being able to click a button like log in and it does it. If you get logged out because another account has logged in, you then have to enter your username and password and go through all of that crap again. Mm-hmm. And then if you do that, without having logged out on the other one and closed the app completely, it then logs that one out and that one needs... It's just ridiculous. And EA does the same stuff. It's like your apps are garbage. The flexibility and convenience they offer gamers is garbage. They're just bad. But like we were talking about earlier, for example, like Borderlands 3 Control, another big thing when you were talking about like being able to install them on secondary SSDs or whatever it may be, that's one level of convenience, right? But if you have like a home server, a NAS, some sort of file server where you have like, you know, fast SSDs, maybe 10 gigabit network, whatever it may be, but you have a central hub for all your games, You can do that with Steam. So I can install one copy of Borderlands 3 on my server with high-speed SSDs, and I can run Borderlands 3 from my server through Steam, right? You can't do that on the Epic Game Store. It won't allow you to have them. You need like an iSCSI target, which is no good for multiple different devices. But I can install Borderlands 3 once in my house, and my daughter can play it from that source at the same time I'm playing it, and there's no performance degradation there. Like, it just works. So that's kind of cool as well. Like, Steam is a central hub for all of your games, and multiple different users can be accessing the same copy of the game at the same time, and there's no hiccups, there's no issues. It just works flawlessly, and I've been doing this for years, no problems at all. Same thing, like, with my Steam games, I have them on my NAS that has SSDs, 10 gigabit network, and if I update Borderlands 3 or Control or whatever game it may be on my Steam account, it's updated for all of the computers that use Steam. Mm-hmm. But with the Epic Game Store, Fortnite gets an update, 20 gigabyte update like it did last week. I have to download that 20 gigabyte update multiple different times. I mean, I could download it once and then manually try and copy it over all the other ones.
Good
and then
luck.
Maybe that will work. Probably not. But my point is, I have to have Fortnite installed in 6 different locations. So Fortnite in my test system setup, and I realize this doesn't apply to all gamers, though again, you might have a home theater PC you game from and a desktop PC you game from. You have to pay for storage to install this game 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. Again, if it was on Steam once, and you only have to download it once. It ties up your internet connection for 20 gigabytes the one time and you're good to go. So,
well, Steam also now has that feature where it does local game transfers as well.
Right.
So you download it once, you leave the PC on, you go to your secondary PC, you click install, does a local copy, which for most people's internet connections would be faster and it, you know, isn't using bandwidth. So yeah, like if Fortnite was on Steam for you, and even if you didn't have a central server set up, you would install it the first time on your PC and then your daughter's PC, you click install and it would just do a local copy.
So it's,
and I know that's a more recent feature.
Yeah, but it's flexibility what we're talking about. They already do these things so much better and they're already in the lead there, but they're like, okay, let's add more flexibility. Let's make this more convenient. Let's make it better. And they seem to be very good at doing that. I've got very few complaints about Steam. And if it's a race, Steam is so far out in front, you can't even see the competitors. And that's not a good thing. Like, I want another game store that is competitive with Steam because we don't want Steam to be the only option.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the issue that the Epic Game Store's had is that their strategy has been, we're going to get people across to using the Epic Game Store because we're going to buy exclusives and offer free games.
Yeah.
And, you know, exclusives, it's like ideally I'd want games to be available on all platforms. So I'm not the biggest fan of exclusives, but I can understand it from a business perspective. And for developers, you know, the deals that are on offer there can often be, you know, actually allow them to make the game that they want to make. The free games, obviously, that's, you know, a very compelling, you know, thing for gamers. But all of those things cost a lot of money. Like buying exclusives is, you know, that's millions and millions of dollars. Buying free games to your store, millions upon millions of dollars. And for some reason, they've invested all that money. Like they're saying they're going to lose $965 million in basically a decade of running the store.
Yeah,
and yet they haven't once thought, maybe we should employ like a couple of more developers to make
a good
store better. Like,
it's like
make the app good first and then buy the exclusives. Like if your whole plan is we want 50% of PC game sales and you're going to, you know, you get people in the door by offering the free games, by offering the exclusives so they're forced to use the store, and then your plan is, well, we want people to be incentivized, they're going to see what it's like, where they're going to use it, why make it crap? Like,
it's crazy.
You have to make it good. The strategy works if the store is actually good and worth using. And all the features we've been talking about, they're not even like some people complain about things like the achievements that you can get with games, the more sort of, you know, the gamery side of things like the achievements, the chat functionality, those things like your friend list. All of those things are common things people say are much better on Steam as well. And we've just been sitting talking for 10 minutes about just basic stuff like downloading games, copying games.
Definitely things we haven't even covered. The more you think about it, the more you come up with. But essentially what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you correctly, is make the game store good and the gamers will come.
I think that's right, yeah.
They've gone the opposite way. It's like they've sat down, they've like, all right, guys, our game store sucks and we have no intention of making it any better. So we need a workaround. And they're like, free games and exclusives. That'll work. It's like, yeah, we could spend hundreds of millions of dollars doing that. Or how much is it going to cost to make the game store good? They're like, not feasible. Go with the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of exclusive and free games. Kind of crazy, isn't it? You would think it's...
Yeah, it's crazy. It's wild.
It's like saying, I want to become a YouTuber and I want to build a successful tech channel. So rather than focus on good camera gear, good testing, a good presentation, making a good video, I'm going to skip all that because that seems too hard. And I'm just going to invest all of that money in buying stuff to give away, and I'll grow my audience by giving them free hardware so then they'll flock to me, which can kind of work, but it's not organic growth and therefore it ultimately fails. And I think the way Epic Games has gone about it, which what we're talking about, is it's not organic growth. People aren't willingly coming to EA Game Store because, like, hey, this is pretty good. This is as good as Steam. Saying, you know, better than Steam might have been a stretch to achieve, but this is comparable to Steam. It's pretty good, and, you know, it's got some great games on it. I like the free games that you get. I mean, honestly, you don't even need to offer that kind of stuff if you just have a good game store. It might have been enough to have a good game store and just be like, we're giving back to developers more than Steam is.
I think that's a key point as well. Like, the thing that's really surprised me is that on Steam, you know, they say that you know, Steam takes about a 30% cut. I think it depends on the level of sales that you get. Like, there's different performance targets that change the revenue split, but generally Valve takes a 30% cut on Steam, whereas Epic only takes a 12% cut on the Epic Game Store. And yet, how often have we seen games being cheaper on the Epic Game Store because of this? Like, never? Like, where's the incentive to buy, like...
That's an incentive for developers, not for gamers.
But I would have thought, like, if you're a developer and you want your to make the most money from your game, wouldn't you be incentivizing people to go over to the Epic Game Store and buy the game for, let's say, $65, as opposed to buying it for $70 on Steam, because they actually make more money from the $65 sale on Epic? But what we've seen is that no developers are willing to do that because incentivizing sales on Epic is, I guess, a losing strategy. Like, they're more willing to take the higher, you know, to sacrifice more money to Valve to get their games on Steam than they are to say, hey, everyone, go over to the Epic Game Store. And I think, as well, Epic were probably gunning for that angle. Like, they were thinking, well, we're offering developers a better split, so surely that will mean they're going to try and encourage gamers to use our store, buy our games on Epic because it's cheaper and we make more money. But that just hasn't happened, and I'm guessing it's because Epic has such a bad reputation with the game store that they're not willing to take the marketing hit by saying, hey, you know, the best platform for this is the Epic Game Store, or only offering it on Epic, or offering it a cheaper price on Epic and, you know, deprioritizing Steam. Like, they're just not, like, it's crazy they're not doing that. It just shows how bad the situation is.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers. Like, if Alan Wake 2 was on Steam, so let's just talk about a popular game that's on both platforms. Does the additional revenue you make on the Epic Game Store amount to anything? Like, if you're selling 10 times or whatever the figure might be on Steam, which wouldn't shock me if that was the case, you're still making more money off Steam, right? So it doesn't matter that the revenue split is greater on the Epic Game Store if you're if you're overall making less money. And really, these days, you want to sell... You want to sell more copies at a lower margin, in my opinion, especially if it's a game that needs a community to work, like a multiplayer game. There's no point getting big fat margins and selling less copies, because ultimately the game's going to die anyway and you'll make less money over time off it.
What would make sense is to have both, you know, have it available on both Steam and Epic. You would sell the Epic copy for a little less and you'd encourage people to buy it on Epic instead of Steam. But even developers aren't doing that. Like, it's pretty much most games are available at the same price on Steam or Epic. It's a bit bizarre there, but I think it all comes down to the actual, like, it's gotten such a bad reputation over the years and they haven't been able to turn that around. Like, everyone's like, oh, you know, the free games are nice, but I'm not going to use it for anything else. It's like, well, that's not a winning
strategy.
Well,
in your opinion, what's the second best game store
It's a tough one. I quite like Ubisoft Connect's ability to find my games and not have to re-download them. But I think in overall functionality, it's probably GOG. GOG Galaxy works quite
GOG,
well.
I find GOG and Epic pretty similar, or am I miles off base saying that?
I think the thing that's turned gets me over the line with GOG is that, first of all, it can find your games. You can locate them quite easily, so that is works well. But also it has the functionality built in where you can have all your games from other stores integrated into the app. So not saying everyone would use that feature, but compared to like an Epic Game Store, you know, you can buy games on Steam or GOG or any other platform that you see fit being the best option for you, and then launch them all from the one application. Now, you can use Playnite, which is another app that does that for you, but that seems like a huge miss for me from Epic Games, where you know, another competitor that's not Steam that sells games and is trying to do things differently has built in this kind of unique selling point to their store and to their application, which is, yeah, please buy the games from GOG, but if you have this big Steam library, no problems. You can launch them from our app. Like, that's all good, all fine. You're going to have Steam installed, obviously, but, you know, at least you can have all your games in the one place. Whereas with Epic, it's like, your Steam library, that's irrelevant to us. Like, we don't care. Like, go to that other second-rate app if you're using Epic. Like, we're not going to bother trying to give gamers an option to switch over more painlessly. Like, because that's what I feel like GOG Galaxy has done, which is offer people that painless transition to a different platform. And Epic just, that's another feature that is like, nah, can't be bothered. But yeah, what would you say is the second best?
Admittedly, I haven't got enough experience with a lot of the other clients, like GOG, for example, to really make or have a valid opinion on that. From the main ones I use, which is Steam, the Epic Games Store, Uconnect, and EA Play, in my opinion, the Epic Games Store is by far and away second best out of those four. Then it would be Uconnect, and then it would be the EA Store. The EA Store is like last by a country mile. Like it's last by so far. I don't know. Don't know what words to use.
And then the Microsoft Store being the just...
That doesn't even rank. That's not even a store. It's just garbage. It's a steaming pile of garbage that has store written on the bin.
I think of the Ubisoft and EA, they're kind of like the vendor exclusive stores, right? Like you basically buy Ubisoft games through the Ubisoft Connect. I think I'd probably have Battle.net as the best of those for Activision games. I tend to find that loading that games are quite large, it has the ability to locate games. It always just immediately updates all games when you load the app. The interface is fast to load. You load into games pretty easily. And yeah, you know, it's not really designed as you buy every single game through Battle.net, but if you do buy a game like Call of Duty or Overwatch or Diablo through Battle.net, it tends to work fine enough.
When I used to play StarCraft 2 a lot, obviously I spent a lot of time, you know, loading up Battle.net, and I always found that to work quite well. But it's not quite in the same league with what it offers, I think, as sort of like the Epic Game Store, for example.
It's got basic functionality, but they've at least nailed the basics, which can't really say for Epic.
Yeah, it seems more polished. The Epic Game Store thing's just really weird. Again, it's a bit perplexing because you and I are sitting here going, this is so obvious, guys. Like, make your store good and the rest takes care of itself. Like, it's so easy, right? Like, I'm sure it's easier said than done, but come on. And it blows my mind a bit because games like Fortnite are still like a huge success after all of these years. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Fortnite, or you think you're familiar with Fortnite, but you don't know why it's so popular, the reason why Fortnite is so popular is because the game is constantly updated in a major way. It's kept fresh. There's new guns, the map changes, the gameplay evolves. They keep adding to it. They keep they might take bits from other games, you know, a bit of movement borrowed from, say, Apex Legends. They'll look at other games, see what they're doing right, what makes their game so fun, integrate that into Fortnite. And it's like almost like a copy and paste job on like all the cool stuff. And Fortnite has certainly its own unique stuff, but it's constantly updated. It's constantly kept fresh. There is so much work put into it. And I don't see that with the Epic Games Store. It's quite strange. And then, you know, Fortnite has the creative modes and it's just games within games within games. Like it's insane how big it is. I'm not seeing that kind of development with the Epic Game Store. Like, has the Epic Game Store really changed in the last few years? I've added a few things,
but not really. Yeah, also, how crazy is it that Fortnite is one of the biggest games on the planet? You have to use the Epic Game Store to launch it. And that also has not driven any other sales to Epic Game Store for other games. Mm-hmm. Like, people are forced to, like, let's say you play Fortnite and other games. Mm-hmm. People are launching Epic Game Store to play Fortnite, and at no point are they like, yeah, this is a good store. I'm going to get all my other games from this place, even though I'm required to install this. Mm-hmm. No one does that.
No.
Like, it's just such a missed opportunity. Like, between the exclusives, Fortnite, the free games, how have they, like, it's mind-blowing that they have squandered that because of the actual features and quality of the application. Like, it's crazy that they have not been able to, like, the fact they're going to lose nearly $1 billion on this blows my mind.
Yeah, but it's all because of, like, it's very simple, guys, as we've been saying, like, make your game store good and the gamers will come. And they either think their game store's good and doesn't need work.
Which they're wrong.
They're very wrong if that's the case. Like, I guess it's hard to really talk about this without knowing, like, where are they coming from? Like, what are their thoughts on their game store? What's their mission here? Like, what are their objectives? What are they working on to improve or add or change? Or is it just going to look like this for the next few years? In which case, they're never going to turn a profit. They're never going to capture gamers with a very subpar product. Steam's free to install. The Epic Games Store is free to install. So it comes down to the usability, the flexibility, which one causes you more grief in your life. And if it's constantly like, oh, I've built a new computer, now I've got to re-download all of my games and try and move things, that's just a headache. Whereas with Steam, you just like put my SSD in, add that to the games library. Oh, there's everything. Click, I'm playing my game. Like, that's what gamers want. Gamers don't want to sit there thinking, oh, how do I move this game from A to B? Or, you know, why is my game not updated? Or why have I been logged out of my client? Why do I have to do my two-factor again? Like, they don't want that. They just want to fire it up, click on the icon. Okay, there it is. There's my game. Click that. Now I'm in my game playing with my friends. That's what they want. It's so simple.
I think it's time to move on to our second topic, which is AMD ending support. Not sure if it's ending, retiring, reducing driver support for older GPUs, specifically from the Polaris and Vega generation. So I'm going to read a quote here from AMD that was published on Anantech, which says, and this is their statement about this, the AMD Polaris and Vega graphics architectures are mature, stable, and performant and don't benefit as much from regular software tuning. Going forward, AMD is providing critical updates for Polaris and Vega-based products via a separate driver package, including important security and functionality updates as available. The committed support is greater than for products AMD categorizes as legacy, and gamers can still enjoy their favorite games on Polaris and Vega-based products. So it sounds like they're not going to be integrating game-specific optimizations into these new drivers, but they will be, you know, if there's any security issues or potential functionality, those will still be available, as opposed to their legacy products, which are more like, here's the final driver for this and good luck.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this? Because immediately I think about how there's some pretty new products that use Vega that are just being thrown in the trash, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really follow the laptop stuff, but there's the Ryzen 7030 series that was announced. I think it was announced late last year, but it was released in January of this year. Are products using
that? And
that's fifth generation GCN, which is, you know, RX Vega graphics. So they've released products that use those graphic architectures this year that presumably will no longer be receiving game optimization updates, just security updates. That can't be right, though, can it? Like, they can't be doing that for products they've just released in the last year or this year or...
I wouldn't put it past AMD to have done that, because it sounds like something that they would do. I mean, for products like the RX 580, you know, Vega GPUs, those were released in 2017, 2018. They're 5-6 years old, and Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of think, okay, NVIDIA...
That's probably reasonable.
Yeah, they technically support GPUs back to Maxwell, which was released in 2014. I think it's questionable how many specific game optimization work is being done for a Maxwell GPU in 2023. I think
zero.
Zero or very limited, like they're including the supported list, so you know it's hard to know for sure, but at least they're, you know, there's a bit of a difference there in terms of support, but I think, you know, RX 580, Vega GPUs, they're old enough now that, you know, you're probably going to be considering upgrading most of the time. Like, they're not the most powerful products. They are going to struggle to run games just based on their hardware. So that doesn't concern me too much. Like, 6-year-old product, you've had a good run, makes sense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's things like Ryzen 5000G series desktop processors. Those those have got integrated Vega GPUs, and they were released, what, like 2 years ago? You brought up the 7030 series mobile, and there's plenty of other mobile GPUs. That's obviously because they keep refreshing older Zen architectures to newer series. But they are released on effectively brand new systems today that will not be getting ongoing support. And I guess you could make the argument as well that a 7030 series laptop GPU is probably not going to be fast enough to actually run games that would benefit from drive optimization. But it's kind of like, it's just a marketing thing as well. Like, having a product released and then within the same year stopping driver support is just a bad look.
It's like, not good.
I would have thought that you'd probably just continue supporting this in the main driver path, but then not necessarily adding in additional software support for the latest games and stuff, which I assume is what NVIDIA is doing with Maxwell, was they're making it like a separate driver package and a separate driver path. Like, what's the point of that? Why couldn't it just be one driver package still?
Yeah, it's a question you have to ask them, but it doesn't seem to make sense. I agree. Yeah, it seems like it's extra work, only going to be negatively received by people with those products. Just seems like you're shooting yourself in the foot there for no reason, which I guess is a sort of an AMD thing to do. So as you say, it's not terribly surprising.
One angle that I'd be thinking of is maybe they're trying to cut down the validation work across the portfolio of products they have. Because, for example, if they released the main normal driver, and let's say they're releasing 15 driver updates a year for that, and then on this legacy older driver, the separate driver package for Polaris and Vega, maybe they only release 4 or 5 updates a year, or even 1 or 2 updates, that means that they can cut out the validation work for 15 driver updates on older products and only do that validation work for 1 update in the year, which would cut out a lot of work. Mm. Is that really a significant factor for them? Especially considering cards like the RX 580, you know, that was a very popular product. I would have thought that you'd want to encourage the owners of, you know, that they invested in a product like that, knowing that, you know, they're going to get the most premium, long-lasting support, that would be a really good sort of marketing feature for them, sort of saying, you know, hey, if you bought that RX 580, yeah, it's still supported today, still a great product. You made the right choice buying an AMD Radeon GPU back in 2018. But now, you know, we've got these new options for you. You can buy an RX 7600, you can buy a 7800 XT or whatever and continue to enjoy our products. But now they're sort of saying, well, you know, move to a separate driver package and, yeah, maybe this will happen in the future for you.
Yes, not a huge issue, but at the same time, I'm not a fan of it. I don't think they should be doing it. Definitely kills the resale value of those products as well. The main reason I'm against it is because, yeah, they've been releasing products up until this year, which is pretty, this year's pretty recent. They've got to support those products. Really, if they want to do 5 years of support, that effectively starts from the last time you release that product.
Yeah, so, and they kind of, in some ways, shot themselves in the foot again by continuing to release Vega-based products up until this year. Mm-hmm. Because if they sort of started to say, well, you know, our GPUs have only got 5 years of driver updates, therefore now, you know, Vega, Polaris-based GPUs are starting to, you know, the desktop GPUs, I mean, are starting to become unsupported, but we're still continuing to support the Ryzen Mobile 7030 series and Ryzen 5000G desktop series, people are going to put two and two together and be like, well, why aren't you supporting my Vega GPU from 2017 when the 5000G uses the exact same architecture and that's supported? So,
well, it makes no sense.
Yeah, by having that architecture available for so long, like continue, like 6 to 8 years of products released on that same architecture, yeah, they're kind of committed to almost support that for 12, 13 years of driver updates, which sounds crazy. Like, that's a very long time, but years beyond a product release today is that sort of that. Those are the numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, I guess my disappointment would depend on whether I bought a 580 or a 7030 series product. But yeah, I think the writing was on the wall here with this a bit. They've started to do this over the last few little bits, trying to branch off the older GPUs into a new driver package, and yeah, not ideal there. Not ideal. We had a reader mail this week. I'm not going to say it's a Q&A question because we do have a Q&A series on Hardware Unbox. So reader mail, let's say, from QH Freddy in our Discord community. And I thought this would be an interesting topic to discuss because it's a bit meta because we're YouTubers. But recently, YouTube has been more aggressively limiting ad block on the platform. So I think now I have YouTube Premium, so I'm actually not super familiar with what happens, but I believe when you're logged out or you don't have YouTube Premium support and you're running an ad blocker on your web browser, you go to watch a video, it now tells you that you have to either whitelist YouTube or disable your ad block to be able to watch the video. Previously, if you had ad block, you could just watch YouTube videos and, you know, they wouldn't serve you ads because they're being blocked. But now they're sort of saying, hey, we want your revenue. So I thought it'd be interesting to discuss this as YouTubers that sort of, you know, are part of this situation. Obviously, ad block has an impact on revenue. Not that I've really looked into it too much, but I would imagine that it would. So do you have any initial thoughts on YouTube increasing their dislike for ad block?
My personal view is they probably shouldn't do it. I don't think it's going to work out well for them. So I get it. They want to make money, and by serving you content effectively for free, it's costing them money to do so. Through, you know, they've got to pay for their infrastructure, their bandwidth, all that kind of stuff. And in my opinion, it's a bit of a miracle YouTube works as well as it does because it's sort of a technical marvel. So I get that they need to make money, right, to support that. But and it's hard for me to have an opinion on this because I don't know, like, how much was people using AdBlock affecting their bottom line? I know the company's not really profitable. Well, the service isn't.
Slightly profitable now, like minor amounts of profit.
Okay, well, that's good then. I know they've been struggling with profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Without knowing the percentage, how many people were using AdBlock, I don't know how detrimental it was to their business model. Like, was it absolutely slaying them and it was going to be the end of YouTube if they didn't take action? So I don't know. I'm not really for it, to be honest, but it's hard to have like a concrete opinion without knowing all of the facts, because obviously we don't want YouTube to fail because that would be bad. And I pretty much watch all of my content on YouTube these days. I don't really watch anything else, but I pay for YouTube Premium. So, you know, I don't need to use an ad blocker.
Yeah, I think I have similar thoughts to you on this. I think I can see people, especially YouTubers, being very firmly in their camp of this is good, because I could see some people coming from the angle of, well, you know, if I'm getting views, but then those views are not actually being served ads, then any potential increase in that sort of audience into being served ads is potentially a net benefit. Because, yeah, let's say you're having a video that got 100,000 views, but 50,000 of those views were not being served ads because they're run with ad block. And then let's say in the future, you know, now we're getting, I don't know, 55,000 views, but all of those are monetized, then you're actually better off with the lower view count. That's, you know, from at least a monetary perspective based on AdSense, you're better off in that second scenario. So I guess YouTube's weighing up, you know, there's going to be a hit to viewership, I would imagine, as people be like, I can't be bothered with this. You know, I don't like the YouTube experience without ads. I'm going to just not watch YouTube anymore. They're sort of weighing that up and going, well, we're going to do that because, you know, the potential to get a 5% conversion on ad blocked, you know, views is going to be beneficial to us overall. I think that some people, I'm not saying I would come with that full opinion, but some YouTubers would have that opinion that it's going to benefit them.
Yeah, I just to jump in, I definitely do not have that opinion. I'm more than happy for our audience to use an ad blocker. I'm just happy they're watching our content and hopefully enjoying it. So that's my first and foremost priority there. And then if they want to support us on Float Plan or Patreon, that's great. If they want to watch the ads to support the channel, then that's great. But if they don't want to do that, I'm just as happy for that to happen. At the end of the day, they're adding value to your content anyway by viewing it. Like, that's not nothing for us. So I'm coming at it from a different perspective to YouTube, but I'm happy to lose money to have people still watch the content.
Yeah, and I think, at least for us as well, like, YouTube AdSense is only one part of our revenue stream. And I think that that's the case for most YouTubers, at least in our position. I imagine smaller YouTubers probably are more heavily relying on AdSense. But these days we have things like Amazon affiliate links and in-stream ads that we sell to, you know, we deal with companies directly to put those ads in the videos. And those are based on just general viewership. Like, whether you've got, like, I know there are utilities you can use to, like, block sponsored ads, but that's obviously much more niche feature than general ad block. And then things just like affiliate links are just generally based on the viewership of the video. Like, the more people that watch, the more likely you are to get someone clicking on an affiliate link and making a purchase. You know, things like a monitor recommendation videos is one example where those videos are significantly funded by, you know, affiliate links. So if YouTube is sort of cutting off that side of things, like saying, well, don't watch the videos because we want AdSense, but we're actually benefiting from things like affiliate links and in-stream ads and getting people to sign up to Patreon, or, you know, the more eyeballs you get, the more likely someone is to potentially do that. You know, those are all going to affect the total experience and the total revenue that we get from YouTube videos, and the, you know, how happy we are with people enjoying the content. So if this is sort of turning people off from watching videos on YouTube and they're less likely to watch, then we're impacted in all those other ways. And that's why I totally agree with you that I'm pretty much against that sort of situation. I am fine with people using Adblock. And I know I've heard some comments from, I can't remember who said it, things like, you know, using Adblock is effectively stealing and it's pirating content. I don't agree with that. Even as someone that, you know, back working for TechSpot, my salary was effectively funded entirely by ads that could be blocked via Adblock. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's kind of odd, isn't it, that I'm sitting here saying, well, part of my money that I make to support me and my family comes from this ads, but I'm actually okay with you not viewing the ads. It's kind of an interesting perspective, but I guess it comes from, you know, we've diversified our income to the level where it's not like, and, you know, we talked previously in episodes about how it's not like we're scrounging for money. We're fairly well off. We have access to plenty of things. We're doing just fine. So by having, you know, a certain portion of our audience using Adblock and not watching those ads, it's like, well, my second Lambo that I was going to buy is just, you know, it's out of the question now. Like, that's the sort of position, I guess.
Yeah, I guess my thought on it is it seems pointless and, if anything, counterproductive to their end goal, because people who are using Adblock, I would have thought, is the minority of viewers anyway. That's an assumption on my behalf, but regardless.
Oh, it would be, simply because most people view on phones and phones are unable to use Adblock in the same way. So
yeah, but regardless of that situation, people who are using ad blockers have gone out of their way to do so. Like, they've looked up and added an extension to their browser, or they're using a specific browser that has it built in. Most people use stuff like Chrome and Firefox, so they've put an extension there. They've actively gone and added that functionality to their experience to not view ads. Now, by you trying to force that person, you're not going to be able to, because first of all, the ad blockers are incentivized to exist and function. So they're just going to continue to work. It's that arms race of we've made ad block detection better. Well, we've made ad blockers better. Well, we've made ad detection better. Yeah. And we've made blockers better. And it just keeps going on and on. And people who don't want to watch ads and want an ad block will always seek out the better ad blocker. So, I mean, if YouTube wants to get into that war with ad blockers, I mean, I guess good luck to them. I don't see it as ever being a winnable war. And you're not convincing the people that use them to change their opinion habits or whatever it is. They don't want to watch ads, so they're not going to. And they're not going to be forced into being like, oh, well, I've been defeated by YouTube, so I guess I'll buy YouTube Premium. Like, that's almost never going to happen. They might get a very small majority. It's like back when they used to pirate video games heavily, or, you know, pirate mute. Remember MP3s? Remember everyone used to just pirate music back in the day. And
it was because
it's because no one wanted to pay for a CD that had a couple of songs on it that they liked, some in some cases one song they liked, and then have to like change CDs. It was super inconvenient. This all ties in with what we were talking about with the Epic Game Store. People don't want to pay for things that are very inconvenient. They want to pay for convenience. So that's why stuff like Spotify, Google Music, all that stuff's hugely popular, because you can just pay a fee every month and get to listen to whatever music you want to listen to, and you don't have to keep changing media files or formats or whatever. That was so bad. I mean, obviously, you know, it was limited by technology, but as the technology evolved to make it better and more flexible, that's what people did. It wasn't really for me, pirating music wasn't because it was necessarily free. It's because it was way more convenient to listen to the music I wanted to listen to, right? And I think that's why most people did it. But as soon as there was a service where I could pay money to get effectively the same thing, I just did that. Like,
100%.
I honestly can say for a long time now, I've pirated nothing. No content of really any. Yeah, I pay for streaming services because it's convenient now. I'm happy with it. I get what I want at a reasonable fee for the most part. Like, okay, if I could pirate Foxtel, would I do it?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, that's
no
very
comment.
Australian specific, but that's very bad
service.
But
I pay a lot of money for bad service for one thing I want to watch, so that sucks. So again, if there was someone that came in and could shake up that monopoly. But anyway, what were we talking about? Ad blockers.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, if YouTube want to convince people not to use ad blockers, they've really got to find a way to make what they're trying to block less intrusive or inconvenient to what it is they want to do.
And I think this is it's almost mixed in with YouTube's general, well, it's actually not even YouTube, it's Google's general revenue stream, which is, Google makes a lot of money from ads on the web. So, and this is across all websites. It's not YouTube, just YouTube. It's they sell ads on many, many, many websites, and they have ads obviously in Google search and stuff. And so a lot of people over the years have been more and more annoyed with how intrusive these ads are on websites. Mm. It went from pretty simple ad integrations to, I mean, the web experience on some websites is disgusting these days with the amount of pop-ups, autoplaying videos. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's horrible. And Google makes money from that. And so over the years, people have been more and more incentivized to use Adblock to get around that. And so now it's coming back to bite them with YouTube, because I think that there would be some people that would use an ad block on websites, but not on YouTube. But it's just more convenient to download the ad blocker that blocks everything. Basically, if Google didn't make all these super intrusive, annoying ads across the web as a whole, it's potentially the case that people wouldn't find the need to use ad block on a website like YouTube, because they wouldn't just be using it by default. They might not even use it at all across the whole web. But because ad block these days is just a one click, you download it, everything's blocked, now they're finding themselves losing out on that revenue on YouTube. Because I think YouTube ads are not amazing, but they're far less intrusive, in my opinion, than pop-up annoying ads as I'm trying to read text on a website on my phone. Like, that's the worst experience. Mm-hmm. So I sort of see it as, them sort of shooting themselves in the foot with that. But on top of that, like, YouTube now is not just about ad revenue for them. Like, they make money through other means. They've got channel memberships as one option for people. They've got premium as well. And premium doesn't just block ads. It gives you additional features that you can use. Like, I think you can play videos in the background on your phone and things like that with premium. And that's a sort of premium exclusive feature. You know, they've got things like super chat and super thanks for live streams and videos. These are all ways that they're sort of making money outside of ads on the YouTube platform. And by turning people away from watching videos, people are not going to be doing super thanks on a live stream. They're not going to be signing up for channel memberships. So I guess they've sort of weighed it up that maybe they can make slightly more money doing it this way. But over the years, if they're trying to grow things like YouTube Premium as not just an ad remover, but also the go-to source for all of the premium additional functionality that they're developing, they're going to need people that are interested in YouTube in the first place to get people to spend money on YouTube Premium. Like, if you're a new, like, let's say you're growing up, you're quite young and you're sort of like, oh, this YouTube experience is kind of gross. Like, I have to turn off my ad block. I'm just going to watch videos on TikTok. And then it comes to later on and they're like, well, we need more YouTube Premium members, and they're trying to incentivize people to sign up to YouTube Premium. Well, they're not going to be a member if they never use YouTube. Like, that person is just a lost cause now.
I see it as they've, well, in my opinion, could be wrong, they've sort of shot themselves in the foot a few different ways. And it's funny you bring up TikTok, because I think that's one way, like the YouTube Shorts, like they're just not monetizable. Like, you have, who is honestly going to pay for YouTube Premium to watch garbage shorts? Like, and let's be honest, most shorts are garbage. Like, the vast majority of shorts are garbage.
It's a monetization challenge, because on YouTube, like with normal long form YouTube videos, you get served one ad every, even with mid-roll ads, maybe every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, let's say, and you're switching between videos, you're watching a video, you get served an ad, then you watch the video. Mm-hmm. No one wants to watch a video ad in between every 1 minute video. Like, no one's going to do that. No. And I guess it's frustrating as a creator that all this focus on shorts when, I'm fine for them to concede that to TikTok. Like, TikTok is doing their thing, YouTube's doing their thing. And in my opinion, long form videos, it's not like they're being replaced by shorts and TikTok content. No. Like, our content wouldn't work as a short. You know, movies and TV if TikTok was destroying things like TV shows, even though we're currently in the pretty much the best era ever for TV content, the amount of it that's being produced for all sorts of types of people, like, it just proves that YouTube has its place doing what it does. And focusing on shorts and trying to get, like, trying to imitate TikTok while simultaneously then going and blocking ad blockers. And at the same time, they also raised the price of YouTube Premium for some users, which is kind of a double whammy. Like, it's not really a good look to raise the price of a service and then cut out ad block. Like,
yeah, I think shorts have been much more detrimental to YouTube as a platform than the ad blocking situation. I think shorts was a bad idea. I don't think it's going to work out well for them. I don't think it can be profitable. Like, this is just my opinion. I could be miles off base here, but that is my opinion. And I think their push for more mainstream content was a big mistake as well. I think they should have been promoting individuals, YouTubers, rather than...
That's what the platform is.
That's right. So they're trying to make they're trying to get away from the essence of what the platform is with all of these bad decisions, in my opinion, that do hurt YouTube. So that I'm more concerned with all of those sort of bad decisions, in my opinion, that they've made over the last few years than the ad block situation. I think the ad block situation has come about because of the dumb decisions they've made with, like, promoting mainstream media, traditional media over YouTubers or independent people, and even our sort of work. And I think shorts is garbage, just personally. I mean, that's a personal bias. I've watched shorts from time to time and I just find them to be garbage, and the shorts I get served are uninteresting. And then if I do watch, like, an interesting short about a cool car or something, I'm like, oh, that was cool. That got me interested. Where's the video? Where can I watch more of this? And before you know it, another short's playing. You're like, no, it's just crap. I don't like anything about it. I try to disable and remove them as much as I possibly can from my YouTube experience.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm very interested to have a look at over time will be, is there going to be a noticeable bump in the revenue for our channel pre and post the ad block situation? Because, you know, the views have been views at the moment haven't been amazing, but that doesn't seem to have correlated with the ad block enabled sort of thing. No. But it'll be interesting to see over time, like, if views are sort of similar, are we going to be making more revenue? But for me personally, like, all the things that we've been talking about still hold true. Even if I started making thousands more dollars personally because of this decision by YouTube, I would still be more in favor of giving the end user the choice to use YouTube in the way that they want to use it. Of course, it gets to a point where, you know, we have to be fair that YouTube does have to make the platform sustainable. They do need to be earning enough revenue from the platform as a whole to make the platform continue to work. So it can't be the case where so many people are blocking ads that the whole platform just crumbles and disintegrates. But I think that prior to this ad block situation, they'd sort of come up with this healthy balance between, we can make enough revenue from people that don't block ads and all of our premium services and features, and especially with the growing, you know, prevalence of the experience on mobile, which again is much harder to block ads on, then, you know, YouTube can be sustainable that way. But they've sort of, they've taken a platform that's potentially sustainable and they've done that corporate, you know, we need unlimited growth, like we need profits to be, you know, higher and higher every single year, which as we talked about in, maybe it's even just the previous podcast about how we run our business and how it's not about let's make the line go up in infinitely and indefinitely and try and, you know, always get those, you know, revenue targets higher and higher. Like there is a sustainable level that a platform like YouTube could operate at where it's profitable or maybe revenue neutral and allows people to use the platform how they want to. So there's always that consideration of like, I'm not super keen on some executive in an office just saying like, hey, YouTube's making us 10% profit, but now we need it at 20% profit. It's like, I don't care. Like I literally do not care about that whatsoever. And I'd just rather people have the YouTube experience that they want. So yeah, could be an interesting, maybe controversial take from YouTubers about how YouTube works. Because I'm, like I said, I imagine that there's some YouTubers out there that have a very different opinion on that. All right, well, I was going to talk about in this podcast episode, Cyberpunk 2077 Phantom Liberty, the tech, not so much the game as in like a game review, but a lot of the tech in the game going through like path tracing, DLSS, frame gen, ray reconstruction, how that actually impacted my 30-hour playthrough of that
game. Your privileged RTX 4090 YouTuber experience.
Yeah, well, may not be quite as positive on that experience as you might think. But
Okay.
We've already been going for an hour. I reckon I've got at least like half, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour worth of discussion there. So we'll leave that for a future podcast episode.
Okay.
Instead, we'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll talk about our boring lives. Steve, give me the updates. What's been happening?
Oh, wow. How much time have you got? Updates. Well, I think I'll start by talking about something I've been working on work-related. Am I allowed to do that in my boring life?
Yeah, depending on how boring it is. Yeah.
It's pretty boring, I promise. So, I probably shouldn't say that because it is and it isn't. One of the key features of Intel's 14th generation CPUs was the APO, the Intel Application Optimization feature software support. Quite interesting. I mentioned it in my review. But didn't test it. And I saw quite a few comments criticizing the likes of Gamers Nexus, us at Harbor Unboxed, and a few others for not looking at APO testing. It wasn't really supported by the time we got to test the CPUs. Like only some motherboards worked. The MSI board we used had no support at the time. It was sort of briefly mentioned by Intel, but didn't go into depth. And there was only two games supporting it.
Yeah. Two older games, right? Like, there weren't even, like, new cutting-edge titles. Wasn't it, like, Metro
and Rainbow Six Siege? Yeah. Rainbow Six Siege makes sense. Okay. Like, that's generally a CPU-limited game where people play at lower quality settings, so you will often be CPU-limited there. So, you know, that makes sense. Metro Exodus makes absolutely no sense. Like, it's not really a CPU-limited game. It's heavily GPU-limited. You're not playing Metro Exodus with low quality settings on high-end hardware, that is for sure. So you're not buying a 14th generation CPU and pairing that with like, I don't know, a 1080 and playing it low. You're just probably not doing that. But anyway, there was two games, largely wasn't supported. A lot of people couldn't get it working. So that is why Gamers Nexus, Harbor Unboxed, and everyone else basically didn't test it. But since then, a few people have tested it. They've found some big gains here and there. And so I thought, well, I should dedicate some content to this and look into it properly. Not saying that I haven't looked into it properly, but you know what I mean. And one of the concerns I had was every single person who had tested it was using the built-in benchmark in either Metro Exodus or Rainbow Six Siege. And I was like, so what are like the benefits of actually playing the game? Like, is the same? Do the canned benchmark gains translate to actual in-game performance? And yeah, largely they do, so spoiler alert, but I had to look into that because it was a question I had and no one who'd done the testing yet had really answered it. And so that content is coming, hopefully, well, it might even be available by the time you watch this podcast, so I think it's probably scheduled to come a day or two after. It all depends. I've largely done my testing. I'm now waiting on Intel because I've put a few questions to Intel. There's a few, I imagine, fairly obvious questions like, One would be, when are we getting more games added to this two games list? It's kind of weird to me that they haven't, because look, APO works and it does boost performance depending on quality settings, how CPU limited by like 10, 20%. So there are some pretty remarkable performance gains to be had there. That's a pretty cool feature. And if they could get that across a wide range of games, even 10%, that really puts the 1400K ahead of AMD's best. That's kind of a big deal. So, yeah, the question is, when are we getting more games added to the list? And the fact they haven't done that already, and the fact that they launched it into kind of, especially Metro Exodus being a weird title, are they able to add this to other games? Did they go through a list of like 50 games and find two where it actually worked? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'd be thinking is like, because it's such a limited selection of games, you know, you can't draw too many conclusions by saying, oh, well, APO gives a 10% performance improvement in games where it's supported, and then extrapolating that to the future, like the future assumption of, well, this will be included for all games, therefore all games will get a 10% performance improvement. Because if the sample size is only two, and that's the two best examples, or potentially other games are never going to work with it or don't provide any performance benefit through it, then, yeah, you could be getting the wrong impression for that from that. So,
yeah. Imagine if they could boost Starfield performance by 10 or 20%, because that game is heavily CPU limited in a lot of areas, particularly yep. where we benchmark. But Starfield wasn't there. So what it leads me to believe it's not possible to optimize for that particular title. And again, Metro Exodus being one of the two games they launched it with suggests to me that this is a bit of a marketing stunt. But I've put it to Intel. I've asked them the question. They're yet to get back to me. I'll give them a few more days. I also asked them, is this a feature that they'll be supporting for future titles? Like if we get a AAA title launched in the next few months or whatever, will APO be supported, you know, out of the gate or soon after? So is it a feature we can expect them to be like actively adding to new games coming out or not? And then is there a technical reason for why 12th generation and 13th generation CPUs don't support APO? I'd love to get their answer on that one.
Good luck getting an answer that fully explains that one.
Well, I've asked them, and I'm more than happy to include their reason, their answer in my video. So there's some of the questions I've put to Intel. Haven't got a response yet. It's been over a day, so I'll give them a few more. And at that point, it's kind of
interesting.
Like,
it's interesting the feature isn't even supported with some of the games I'd say are more, not necessarily Intel sponsored, but Intel has put more work into and is had more of an integration with things like Hitman 3, for example. I think that was one of the first titles that supported XeSS. Assassin's Creed Mirage is sort of a newer title that comes to mind that I think either is an Intel-sponsored game or at least has a lot of Intel's features in the game and was sort of being talked about as being one of Intel's titles. So, yeah, it's a bit surprising that, yeah, while they are potentially getting GPU features into those games, that, yeah, APO, yeah, launching in two titles is very, it's odd, especially if that's supposed to be like a key selling point for a new generation. But then again, we've seen that with plenty of GPU features over the years. So launching in one or two games, and we're expected to just believe that's what's going to be like across a wide variety.
It raises some concerning questions, and I'm concerned that we're not going to see it in many more titles, and it's just going to be one of those features that showed great promise in a couple of games but was really only suitable for a couple of games. But anyway, we'll see. Yeah, really keen to hear back from on that one. Other than that, though, I've been working on the under deck shed garage conversion thing. It was really cool this morning. I got out there for an hour because I had to set some posts in concrete. So I thought if I do that first thing, you know, they'll be done, and the concrete I'll have time to cure. And I've got a little mini skid steer. Like, I don't know if a dingo for the mini skid steer brand is Australian, right? I don't think they'd be in the US. I think it's
I'd assume with that brand name, dingoes being a native Australian animal, it's probably just Australian.
Yeah, I don't know if they've made their way over to the US, but I doubt it. But they'll have Kubota or some of those sort of brands would probably offer mini skid steer type devices in or machines in the US. Anyway, I have a rather large mini skid steer that can lift 400 kilos or kilograms. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool little machine. And I've got an auger for it. So I put a 450 auger on it this morning. Drilled two holes just over a meter down. It did it. It was in fairly hard soil, like clay, and yeah, went through it effortlessly. So drilled those out and concreted in some mild steel posts that were galvanized. And it was a pleasure, I guess, is the point I'm trying to get to, because nice. Digging holes, digging post holes is one of the crappiest jobs you can possibly do when it comes to like landscaping and building and all that kind of stuff. It is not fun. And I've had to do them by hand in the past. So now that I have my mini skid steer with a powerful auger, whoa, so good, mate. Like nice. Drilled those two holes out in 5 minutes, didn't break a sweat. And yeah, if you've ever dug a deep hole, like a post hole with a shovel, man, there's an art form to it. And it's mostly a backbreaking art form. Like it's so difficult to do. Not fun, especially in like hard soil. So I did that. And then took me 5 minutes. And then I spent about 15 minutes being very pleased with it. and then I got the cement mixer out, mixed up some cement, made some concrete, essentially, is that's what you do. And then took the concrete in a wheelbarrow, poured it in the hole. And yeah, now I've got two very straight posts. So once that goes off, I'll be welding some cross beams to it. I might put some photos in the BTS section on Discord, but it's all going well. It is going nice. Well. So
nice.
Yeah, that was fun. And then, I came back inside and did a bit more APO testing. And yeah, I've pretty much got that done now. So I'm just waiting on Intel to get back to me. And nice. Yeah, I'll have some other testing to do over the weekend. But yeah, that's pretty much my boring life since we last chatted.
Well, my boring life includes cricket, which some people would think is extremely boring. So I'll bore people by talking about the Cricket World Cup, which is currently going on. So, the one-day international cup at the moment. And a couple of nights ago, Australia was playing Afghanistan. And with these games, it's the tournament's in India. So they started around 7:30 in the evening for us here. But the game won't be finished until about 4 a.m. because they're supposed to go all day, but because of the time zone difference, doesn't work out too nice for us. But anyway, I started watching the game and, Australia was kind of getting flogged a little bit, especially once they got to the batting innings for Australia, who were batting second. And it was getting to the point where I was like, Australia's really getting beaten down here. It was about midnight. I'm like, oh, I should probably stop watching this. Like, it's not particularly interesting. But I started making some notes for this podcast at that time. I was like, I'll just start jotting down some notes and then I'll go to bed. That sounds like a good use of my time because this match is pretty boring.
That's when it's going badly.
That's when, it's like got to interest myself with a few other things. Anyway, that's when Glenn Maxwell of Australia started destroying Afghanistan in one of the greatest one-day performances of all time in cricket. He scored 201 runs off 128 balls. If you don't know what cricket is, then all of this will make absolutely no sense. But one of the most impressive things was that he basically like couldn't move halfway through the innings. So he got injured, was having cramps and stuff, and was like lying on the ground, like he was getting work done, and he still absolutely dominated this match, which was pretty incredible. I ended up staying up until like 3 a.m. or something watching the end of this because it wasn't looking like Australia was going to win at all, but because of this performance, he ended up winning and he hit a six on the last ball to get his 200, which is quite nice. So that was good. Enjoyed that. Shouldn't really be staying up to like 3:30 a.m. on a weekday, but whatever. Didn't hurt my work too much the next day. And also this week, I finally got around to watching Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. I haven't been super impressed with Marvel films lately, so I've kind of been like, I'll just wait forever to watch this to watch that film. But I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good.
Okay.
So I'm not a movie reviewer or anything, but some of the previous Marvel films that I would have seen were things like the Doctor Strange sequel, which I wasn't super happy with, didn't think it was that enjoyable. And, the Eternals, that wasn't very good. But Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 was, I've quite enjoyed the Guardians of the Galaxy films over the journey. And this one was pretty similar to the previous ones in terms of it being quite good and not sort of having all that, you need to watch like a million Marvel TV series and movies beforehand to understand what's going on, understand who the villain of the current era is and like all the relationships between the superheroes.
Which isn't contained. Bad if the content's good, but a lot of the TV series were pretty bad. And I was a big fan of the Marvel stuff early on as well and really enjoyed it and grew tired of it once it started to get very garbage. I've not watched it. My daughters have seen it because they're still sort of selectively into Marvel. So yeah, I'll have to give that a watch, I reckon. It's, I'm just looking now on IMDb and user like audience ratings, and it looks well received compared to a lot of the other Marvel stuff that we've seen.
Yeah, over the last few years. It's like an oversaturation of things. Like, I don't think we really need like 20 TV series from Marvel and like 3 or 4 movies every single year.
I mean, if they're good, you'd welcome it, right? If they were like very, very good, but they're very, very bad. So I think that's more the problem.
Yeah, I think part of it as well.
And the problem is because they've pumped it out too much, which, you know, like you can't maintain that.
You can have like you could have 20 TV series and 5 movies a year if they were all really good. But I think as well part of it is you kind of like Marvel films almost always follow some variation of the whole formula. Like there's this villain that comes from nowhere basically and, you know, oh, they've got to fight the villain and he's destroying the world. And you notice that formula more when you're watching 4 or 5 of those films every year. Like if it was once a year.
That's the lazy part though, right? Like if there's more effort put into the storytelling, then that's a symptom of just making it cookie cutter, Call of Duty problem where they're just pumping out the same crap to make money. So you're saying.
I think Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 succeeded because it does follow directly on from the Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special, which is like a 40-minute sort of TV/movie thing you could watch on Disney Plus.
Okay.
But it's not really, you don't really need to know that to go into the film. Like you don't need to have watched that. It's very much contained, like, all the villains and stuff is not like, who was that the villain from that show? And like, did I miss something there? It's like, it's all pretty well contained. And I think, what movie was I watching? I can't remember which one it was because there's so many of them now. But one of them, they keep having these villains that sort of like just come out from nowhere. And it's like, where were you during the like whole Endgame thing? Like you were just hiding in a hole somewhere. Like, why weren't you joining in? Like, what was going on there? So that was kind of annoying. But I agree. I haven't been super impressed with a lot of the TV shows. That said, I've been watching. I'm very much out of date on like the Loki TV show, which is in season 2 at the moment. And I thought that was one of the better shows in season 1. So sort of interested to see more of how that goes. But the other shows, questionable in terms of quality. But Star Wars is suffering from the same thing as well. Some of the shows
like the first season of The Mandalorian was epic in my opinion. Loved it for the most part. And then season 2 was okay from memory, and there's just been the season 3, right? I'm not making that up. Yeah, and that wasn't very good. It was just probably why I don't remember it that well. I wouldn't say it was terrible, but it was nowhere near as good as season 1. And then Boba Fett was pretty terrible. I mean, I wanted to like it, but I did watch it all, but it was not good. And then Ahsoka was, I don't know, it didn't really go anywhere. You watch that?
I'm like halfway through watching it, but it hasn't.
Okay,
it hasn't
I won't super, say anything then.
It hasn't super grabbed me, but I think that show relies heavily on whether or not you watched Star Wars Rebels, the animated show.
Which I did and quite liked that.
I thought the Rebels was really good. The show's, it's like I said, it hasn't super grabbed me or anything. It's like, it's fine enough. But I think
the storytelling wasn't great in it. Let's just say that.
I think some of the things that have annoyed me a bit about the Star Wars shows has been like, you've got great characters from the movie franchise like Boba Fett who really deserved a better show than that.
Oh, like, so much better.
I know they got the same actor who did the clone stuff from the prequel series, and that was sort of a nice sort of continuation of that same actor. But also, it would have been more interesting, in my opinion, to get like an origin story of like what happened, what happened to him to become a bounty hunter, as opposed to the he's now sort of an old man thing. And there was a similar issue with the Obi-Wan show. I didn't think the Obi-Wan show was terrible, but it's like we're talking about one of the it did recover, but it's one of the greatest characters in the franchise.
Sure.
And obviously, Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader was in the show as well, and that's one of the greatest characters. And I think they could probably do a bit more justice to that than they did in that show. So, hopefully with some of the other shows that they're developing, they sort of find a niche or even do like an Andor thing. Andor's another show I haven't finished yet because, I don't have heaps of time to watch these TV shows, but that's sort of more like the contained story. Like you don't, it's not just relying on let's put the cool character from the movies yeah. into a show and make it around that. It's like, let's tell an interesting story. At least with like, yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy and some of the Marvel stuff, they're able to do that. Like Loki was sort of, you kind of need to know what Loki, who Loki was as a character, but it was kind of all contained within that sort of TVA type scenario where they're going off and doing their own thing. Whereas, yeah, some of the other shows have been just like, yeah, as I said, yeah. not impressive.
I didn't watch Loki. I'd lost interest by that point. I'd sort of checked out yeah. for the most part. The Star Wars, because, yeah, I've been watching Star Wars since I was a kid. So whenever there's a new Star Wars thing, I'm like, oh, all right, I've got to watch yep. this. Please don't suck. But yeah, Andor yep. was quite good. I didn't mind that. Bit slow, obviously, in parts, but still interesting and quite very well done. The Obi-Wan started pretty poorly, in my opinion. Didn't really like that, but it yep. came good and sort of saved itself at the end for me. But anyway, there's yeah, a lot of these franchises have been done quite poorly, in my opinion, compared to how epic they could have been.
And also, I'll just briefly mention, you've watched and liked The Boys, haven't you? The sort of superhero yeah. show that's on Amazon Prime.
yeah, have you watched I watched that late. Show? No, I got to The Boys very late. My cousin Chris actually made me watch that when he came down. And yeah, quite enjoyed it in the end. Haven't watched the spin-off, no.
So the final episode of Gen V, which is the spin-off to The Boys, I think it aired last week or the week before, I've watched the whole series now. And I went in with like low expectations, kind of thinking, I guess, like sort of, oh, it's a spin-off. Like yep. spin-offs are usually bad, or they'll do a Marvel thing where they like try and oversaturate it with garbage. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought Gen V was very good. So it's definitely worth watching if you enjoyed The Boys. Yeah, obviously they've got, you know, a whole new set of different characters, but yeah, the story's pretty compelling and good, and they sort of don't flub it. so that was very pleasing.
I'll watch that. We can talk about next time because I watch these shows while I'm benchmarking. Like, isn't that when you Star Wars? I don't. I usually watch those with my wife, and that's why we struggle to get through them all in time because we both got to have time yeah. and the energy to watch them. But like The Boys, for example, I just binged that while I was benchmarking. So
yeah,
it means I can't give it my full focus, but I get the gist of it. I watch enough of it.
Yeah, like I tend to have the shows that I watch with my partner, and you know she's interested in watching things like The Boys and the Star Wars shows and things like that. So mm-hmm. we have like the shows that we watch together, which is probably most of the TV that I watch. And then mm-hmm. there are some shows that I sort of just watch while I'm benchmarking. So there'll be things that you know she isn't interested in. Recently, my sort of go-to benchmark show has been BattleBots. Which is, you know, the competition robot show. Which,
yeah.
You know, it's very digestible. There's lots of filler in it as well. So like you can pay attention to the fights, but then the sort of in-between stuff, I can be doing things. Also shows like air crash investigations, those sorts of things, which, you know, sort of documentary style things, just interesting things like that. But there could be the occasional, like I've been watching The Walking Dead as an example of a sort of more of a narrative show that I'd watch during benchmarking.
Man, I stopped watching that after like season one or something.
But yeah, it's pretty. So there was a very mediocre patch of a couple of seasons. I still haven't
finished.
Might
have been season. Yeah, might have been halfway through season two. I got bored with it. But yeah, I know people went nuts with it.
Yeah, so it's gone in some interesting directions. But yeah, so those are the sort of shows that I'd watch while benchmarking, or just like podcasts or YouTube videos. Because often if I'm doing quality comparison work, it's very difficult to sort of watch a show and do that.
You can't. Yeah. Yeah. The podcasts are huge for me because you listen to those while you're focusing on the testing. So yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts. So that's also good.
All right. Well, that does it for the Hard Run Box podcast episode 12. Got the right number in there. Hopefully you all enjoyed the show. And as I've said in the previous episodes, if you do want to get these slightly earlier, the audio feed is the way to do that because we just publish them when they're ready. The video feed does come out slightly later usually. So audio feed available on all your podcast apps. And yeah, if you want to submit feedback or respond to some of the things we've been saying, give your own opinions on things like Epic Games being garbage and driver updates and YouTube ad blocking, the comments of the YouTube video is probably the best way to do that. Alternatively, if you are a Patreon or Floatplane member, we have got our podcast Discord channel in there where you can chat to us about the podcast and even give us a few listener mailbag type stuff. There's one question as well that we got from Alvin that I have flagged for a future episode, very in-depth about optimization and upscaling and things like that. Wants to get our thoughts on that. So I've saved that for a future podcast. So Alvin, if you're listening, we will get to that in the future. So That's it for this one. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you, or you'll hear us, in the next one.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.